This is Leslie Scheel speaking with Steve Scafidi about his book, Sparks from a 9-Pound Hammer. I love that this poem, The Hay-Filled Chandelier, you had told me before that one of your mother's closest friends was moving away, and you wrote this poem as a space for them to come together. And whenever I read this poem to students, I think of you as an architect and a builder, that you have literally built a place between here and California where these two women yeah. could be together in this poem. And I love that.
I know. I like to think of it as I'm a road builder there.
I love it. Road builder. That's great. You know, and talking about this urgency and how each poem is an occasional poem, this morning I was reading one of the letters that you sent me with a possible precursor to this book, a manuscript called The Fifth Horse.
That's right.
And you had written to me four concerns that you had about the manuscript. And near the end of this letter, I love what you're writing here, and I'm thinking about this in connection to the urgency and the need for the poems. At that time, you were thinking a lot about the epic. You were in Arizona, sort of working that out. And you say, this obsession with epic has had a stronghold on me. Throughout this process, I have discovered the truth of something I knew all along. Poems come from inside something. They are the passage out of that thing. The trouble I've had is projecting, in quotes, long poem, end of quotes, onto something, rather than having the faith of a farmer, that green comes from underground by its own kind of muscle. Steve, in this book, and when you write poems come from inside something, they are the passage out of that thing. Do you have any thoughts about what the passage with this book has been? Or is it still too soon to its publication?
I like that question. It is soon, but I do think that there is this kind of organic departure from what you've done in the past. And I think that, as a matter of fact, there's been a kind of resistance I've noticed in writing some of my new poems. There's been a resistance to any kind of resemblance of the poems I've been writing to what is in the book. And that resistance is really ridiculous, you know, and I respect it, and I'm going to honor it somehow with poems in the future. But for now, I think, you know, you need to move along. And so there's going to be a clear resemblance, and that's a good thing even. It is early to talk about it, but I'm curious. And that is, I think, what makes us curious as writers, when we have a poem and we're done with it, and then you think, what's next?
Well, I'm imagining that the third party in our conversation would be anybody listening to the interview, and there may be beginning writers out there who are wondering how to start to make their words public, and people who have been doing it for a while who may be in a stuck place. And I'm thinking about when you were in Arizona, that there was a period of time there where you became very self-conscious about revising. And you told me that every time you had a pencil in your hand, you would start to write something and then erase it. And it became hard. And I think that most writers come to that point in the process. Like, when do you learn to let fly? And where does the act of revision really deepen and help? And where does the editor become too strong? Mm-hmm. And at that point, you gave yourself an assignment where you would write across the page, and you had a whole set of requirements for yourself that I'm going to ask you in a minute. But the number one thing I remember about that conversation is that you told yourself in starting to write you would not allow yourself to erase for this series of drafts for a period of 3 months, that if you had written, let's say, a gnat into the first line of the poem, you could not erase that gnat. If you did not want that gnat in there, you had to kill the gnat off in the next line or in the body of the poem. Can you talk to us about that assignment and how, as you said later, it led to such poems as the gorgeous and erotic The Latitudes of Desire?
That's interesting, because I know that poets like Charles Wright speak proudly of their powers of erasure and tearing holes in paper with that eraser. I know about that, but I think it can be murderous at times, especially for a young writer, that I think that you can get too precious, especially in a first draft, where for me, I can't do that, because it stops everything up and it just ends up killing things. So what I did was, and I found that I was being murderous to my imagination, it felt like nothing was good enough. No imagining whatsoever was good enough for me, which was ridiculous and is bad for you. So I said, well, let me defy this by no matter what. And I set up a group of rules about what I was going to do, and it ended up being my thesis, which I don't even know if I consider them poems necessarily, but I love them because how much I learned from that experiment. And I think that is something that MFA programs should be used more often as an experiment. But the rules I set up were that I was going to write 100 poems minimum, and they were going to each be 28 lines, and the lines were going to be the long as the margin of a piece of loose leaf paper. And I was going to celebrate nonsense in these, and I was going to move by rhyme and by rhythm, and I was going to not erase, but like you said, revise. If I didn't like something that was showed up earlier, it had to be changed by what I wrote next. So that that was fascinating. And what it ended up doing, and I think this is important, especially for young writers to remember, that it affirmed every day I was right there letting things happen. And it's not free writing so much, because I did have enough rules, some I haven't mentioned, that kept it regulated somewhat tightly. Mm-hmm. But at the same time allowed for this flow of language that I think that we have going on at all times. I think, you know, we dream at night, no matter you're writing or not, and no matter you remember or not, you are dreaming. And I started to believe that we're dreaming at all times, you know, even when we're awake. And so that increased my urgency to be present to the page and just start writing and see what would happen. And I found it was extraordinary. All these fascinating, nonsensical rhythms and stories just poured forth every day. It was something brand new, and I was shocked. Aww. And I started to be so grateful, and started looking at the first draft as this holy thing. And I think about William Stafford sometimes, and he was such a poet of the first draft. And it is an amazing thing when you go from nothing to something, no matter what that something is. It's miraculous for us. And so I've always remembered to celebrate that and never forget that. And I've since learned to love revision. And I do think that it still takes a good bit of, you know, we're always cultivating this critic, our own critic, that we need to write poems. And it's easy for that critic sometimes to go overboard, or for us to have a misunderstanding with our critical powers. And so that our critical faculty just takes over and will kill things, at least mine will often. So I have this constant battle. But for the most part, I've come to really enjoy revision as adventure.
Oh, I love that.
And that often in a first draft, the miracle that it is something that's full of opportunity. And that's the way I go back to my poems, is thinking about opportunity.
I love that. Revision as adventure. Let's talk about that practically in the life now.
Okay.
Huge changes in the life, yeah, and what that does to revise maybe your process of writing. And a little context here. When you lived in Virginia, you used to take long night walks through the fan. I mean, it seemed to me that you were a person who loved long periods of solitude. And you knew what to do when you needed to give your writing life something new. You told me once what an algebra class did for you. And then you told me once that you waited out a semester and washed dishes at the Strawberry Street Cafe because you needed to do something physical, and then got back into the work. Then you moved to Arizona, and you wrote once that it takes you a good 6 months to get used to a new landscape. And now you're a new father. And so those long periods of solitude maybe changed. What do you do in the life to get back to a kind of steadiness, if that is important? And how does reading play a role in that during times of transition?
I find that when I'm not reading, I'm probably not writing. And I find that reading has always come first in a way. Without reading, I don't really know what I'm doing. And I often don't trust what I'm doing if I'm not reading something. And there are touchstone poets who I return to regularly in times of crisis or the opposite, when I need a kind of meditation or I need a kind of calm that's familiar to me, I'll return to those poets. And at the same time, try to keep a steady stream of poets I'm unfamiliar with or from the past and currently. That's important.
What happens to your writing? Do you just ride with the change? Do you keep with it daily?
Well, that's interesting that my wife Kathleen and I had a child, Isabella, and that does, and I know you have a beautiful daughter, Jordan, and it changes your life, I think. I know. And it's only dawning on me probably, but it changes your life. And I am someone who loves solitude, and I think a lot of writers are, and we require it even. And so it's been a real challenge to find that old kind of calm. But I think what's called for now as your life changes is a new kind of calm. There's a new way of meditating in a practical daily way. I've never been someone who sat down and closed my eyes and sat quietly. I'm too restless to do that. I make a terrible Buddhist, that make a terrible congregant of any church because my knee is always moving. So taking walks and writing poems is the closest I can get to that. And so I have found it to be a challenge, but I think it's imperative also to find ways to cultivate that kind of restless peace.
Well, Steve, I'm wondering if, to end, unless there is something else that you really want to say, I've got two things going through my mind. One, this poem, Ferocious Ode, seems to me to be such a poem that talks about that hum and whir, that there could be something like a family drama mentioned, and then it goes straight from abstraction into it breaks dishes, that the poem constantly undercuts itself and then evolves into something else, breaks and evolves, breaks and evolves. So I'm wondering if you would be willing to read that poem and then to possibly end the interview by telling us one story of the tribe, something that happened to you in poetry, maybe with another poet, a story, a word this poet gave you that you could also give to our listeners today.
This poem is called Ferocious Ode. It tells you the name of the flower you love. It takes the shape of an old woman working a pitchfork in the hay of a garden growing voluptuously every day in your heart. That is to say, it, being mysterious, is difficult to describe simply and with candor. It grabs children in their dreams like tigers grab gazelles. It grabs tigers. It makes me say the sweet convolutions of poetry are not so sweet sometimes. And my grandfather claws the red clay walls of hell for what he did to my father. And I am happy on summer days when the lily that I love bobs and sways in wind like fire on a ladder. It matters. Like a ladder on fire, it is spiritual. Like the simile in which a house burns down inside a boy, it is tragic. It turns and turns, laughing like a nun. It is non-sequential, baffling, and close to death, like a woman turning a pitchfork in her garden. Her diary reads, "I loved him." It is one page after the last page in my grandmother's diary. It is the afternoon, and the sun is setting coldly over my father's head, the oval of which he has passed down to my sisters. It is a family drama. It breaks dishes. It runs to me with kisses, soft, and with claws. It blooms at night also, my tiger lily, loss. I think I'd like to say something about Larry Levis. He's not someone that I knew personally, though I did go to one of his readings in Virginia, and you were there. Afterwards, in his hotel room, there were about eight people hanging around, relaxing, watching a really terrible horror movie on the TV and making fun of it so delightfully. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh, this is one of the wonders of life, that you can sit in a room with strangers and friends and a poet who you admire and have a great time and know you're probably going to leave in 15 minutes and it's all over with, but you're not going to forget it. I think that there is something about Larry Levis's poetry that that I think is freeing for so many of us who love his work. And I think that he's one of those poets who's always giving you permission to move along and to try the new thing, because he does it so richly in all of his books, and he does it so deeply and deeper in each successive book, that he also gives you hope, I think, as a writer, that there's going to be a really interesting evolution in your life and in your work, and you can't guess it, but you have to write your poems to find it out.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. It's been a delight, and I look forward to an ongoing conversation.
Me too. Thanks.